nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
The last few days, we have been talking about this concept of spin and how to include it in a device description. And of course, we have the basic equations that we have discussed earlier back in February, and which kind of are summarized on this page, which is why I handed this out so you'd have this in front of you anyway. And these equations are perfectly general, whether you include spin or not. Point is, once you have the matrices H and sigma, it's basically the same equations. Okay? And as I've mentioned, what spin entails in terms of your actual calculation is that the matrices get twice as big, because conceptually it's as if every point now is composed of two points, an up component and a down component. Okay. And what I wanted to go through today was just a simple example, just to show how it works. And one of the important new concepts I wanted to get in is how you'd actually calculate the spin density or the spin current. That is, usually we talk about electron density, electron current, charge current. And that we have seen how to calculate. That is, in a given device, for a bias condition, you could figure out what would be the electron density inside. And as you know, there is this quantity called the correlation function that we have discussed before, which comes from taking sort of the psi-psi dagger, right? That is, if an individual electron has a wave function looking like this, psi with multiple components, and psi dagger would look something like this. And when you multiply it out, you'd get a matrix. So if there are 4 points, you'd get a 4x4 matrix. And as we have discussed before, the diagonal elements of that matrix represent the electron density at those points, whereas the off-diagonal elements have information about phase relationships, which, you know, do not have a direct physical interpretation normally, but are important, of course. Now, usually if you want electron density, you then just look at the diagonal elements. That's the usual idea. Okay. Now, once you get into spin, of course, every point, even if I stand at one particular point in your device, say I'm standing right here, it's still got 2 components, the wave function, which what that means is this correlation function, the GN, is actually a 2x2 matrix. And this is one case where the off-diagonal elements have a very simple physical meaning also. And that helps understand the meaning of off-diagonal elements in general to some extent. As I've said, although we are talking about spin, it is really illustrates some of the deepest issues about that this quantum viewpoint raises in many ways. Okay. So what I'd like to talk about today, and what I'm really trying to illustrate in a way, is how would you actually calculate, say, the spin density inside your device? You know, how much spin has accumulated at different points? And a related quantity, what is the spin current? Because that actually is a very important thing in many devices that are, you know, gradually becoming important. That is, one of the most important developments in our area, I'd say, in the last 5 years or so, is this concept of spin torque. And that is, before this, if you wanted to turn a magnet, usually you'd have to apply a magnetic field if you want to flip a magnet. Whereas what has now been shown is that if you have a small enough magnet, like somewhere here, let's say you had a small magnet, thin magnet, then just by injecting spin currents, you can flip it. You see, which has enormous practical implications, because magnetic fields are hard to control. You know, it's hard to make them smaller and smaller and localize them in small regions of space. Whereas spin currents, you know, you can almost deliver it surgically at different places in a way. So it has all kinds of implications and possible applications. But as a physical phenomena, this idea that you could flip a magnet with a spin current rather than with a real magnet magnetic field. That is a very new development, like wasn't known 5 years ago. Anyway, so those are the kinds of things I want to illustrate just with a simple example today. Now, first question you could ask is, like, if I have calculated Gn, as I've said before, the basic equations are all here. Once you have written down H's and sigmas, we can calculate all these things. So supposing I've calculated Gn at a particular point, what that means is at that point, it would look like a 2x2 matrix. Okay? Because the psi is a two-component wave function, up and down components, and then the psi dagger has up and down two components. And so when I multiply those two things, I'll get a 2x2 matrix. And if I look at this element, that will tell me, you'd think, the density of upspin electrons. And if I look here, it would tell me the density of downspin electrons. That seems like a pretty clear. So now my question is, how do you think I would calculate the net spin density at a point? Okay. So if I wanted the net electron density, I should just add these two. You know, because this tells me the density of upspin electrons, this tells me the density of downspin electrons. Just add the two. That gets me the total density of electrons. Makes good sense. Now, what about if I wanted to know the net spin? What should I do? I should subtract it. Okay, that many upspins, that many downspins. If it's equal, there's no spin. So look at the difference. So one way to write that would be, if I really want the spin density, what I should do is take the Gn matrix and look at the difference between its diagonal elements, which would be sort of like taking the Gn matrix. I'm just writing it out here. Multiplying it with 1, 0, 0, minus 1, and taking the trace. You see? And this quantity, if you might remember, is the Pauli spin matrix sigma c. What you can convince yourself, I believe this is that if I take the trace of this, I'll actually basically get the difference between those two things. That you can check easily. Because when I'm taking trace, all that matters is the diagonal elements of the resulting matrix. Right? Because trace means I'm just adding all the diagonal elements. So what will I get here? Well, it will be this times this plus this times 0, which means basically it will be this guy. Okay. Now, when I want to calculate this one, this 2-2 element, I'm taking this, multiplying with this. So that's this times 0, that's gone. And so this times minus 1. So it's negative of whatever's here. And so when I take the trace, basically I'm taking the difference between those two. Because I'm just adding it up. So this would be just another way of writing something you instinctively feel sounds right. Okay. Now the reason I'm writing it this way is that this method is easily generalized to tell you like how to figure out the x component of the spin, for example. So z component of the spin is easy because, you know, up gives you something, down gives you something, look at the difference, easy enough. But what's the x component of the spin? And the answer is, well, there's no simple way to see that, but the basic answer you could reason this way. You could say that if I had used up and down along x as my basis, then it should have worked exactly the same way. You see, usually you're using plus z and minus z as your basis. But supposing I had used plus x and minus x as my basis, then I could have done exactly the same thing and figured out, I could have taken the trace of that, and that would have given me how much net spin I have in the x direction. Okay, So that's what I'd have if it is plus x and minus x. But let me get it back to this basis, because that's why the basis I normally work in, that's the basis everything is in. So let's get back here. So what that means is I have to do this unitary transformation back. And you know this unitary transformation, we have talked a few times about that. You have to put a u in front, a u dagger here, and how you write all that. And I think we went through this once. If I transform this x back into z, what will it look like? Right. Then it will look like the sigma x, basically. So that thing transformed back will end up looking like this. So finally, the bottom line is, if you want to know the spin in the z direction, multiply gn with sigma z, take its trace. If you want spin in the x direction, multiply with sigma x, take its trace. If you want to say spin in the y direction, multiply with sigma y, take the trace. That's it. You see? So the general principle then would be that anytime you want a spin in a particular direction, whatever your favorite direction, so you want the spin vector, what you should do is you should take trace of gn sigma. Of course, when I write trace, it doesn't matter in what order I write it. I could always turn it around. Trace is the same anyway. And I write this in a vector sense. What that means is if I want sx, I should use sigma x. If it's sy, I should use sigma y. Sz, I should use sigma z. That's it. That would be the idea. Now, similarly, if you actually wanted, say, spin current. So if you remember, this I'll come to a little later. The spin current is a little harder concept. If you remember back in February when we talked about spin currents, you know, in the sheet I handed out today, that expression 4 was what we had got for the current operator in general. And the way we got the current operator was by saying that in order to discover what you should call current, you should look at del del t of psi psi dagger. Because this is like this gn, like the electron density. And if you look at the rate at which it's changing with time, that's what you could associate as a current operator. Of course, we are doing all steady state calculations, so that is actually zero. So whatever appears in number 4, if you look at all these terms together, that will always give you 0. But you could separate it out into which part comes from contact 1, which part comes from contact 2, and so on. And the fact that the whole thing is 0 simply means that the current at all the terminals added up is 0. But if you look at the individual terms, one of them will give you the current in contact 1, one of them will give you the current in contact 2. This was the subtle argument that we discussed back in February. And you'd have to go back to that, essentially, to figure out how to calculate a spin current, for example. And that we'll do later. So the basic idea would be if you wanted spin current, you'd have to do something like trace of, you know, instead of gn, now you use this current operator that we talked about, times sigma. If you are at a particular point, then you look at these. This is like a 2x2 matrix at that point, and you work with that. That's what you'd have to come back to. Okay. So anyway, first let's just focus on the spin itself, and then we'll talk about spin current. The spin current, as I said, is particularly important because when you're actually trying to flip a magnet, how much force you exert on the magnet is kind of dependent on the spin current part. That's what kind of tells you what torque you're actually exerting on the magnet. So let's take a simple example and go through this. Now, in this discussion, I also want to kind of get you a little more used to this using the Pauli spin matrices. So although a lot of this stuff I'm doing, it basically involves 2x2 matrices. And if you hadn't heard of Pauli spin matrices, you could just have done it without using that notation. But it's very convenient once you know it, because those matrices have certain properties that once you know it, you don't have to go over them repeatedly. So for example, I try to summarize one property here. It goes like this. I mean, kind of looks formidable. You don't quite know what that means. But basically what it's saying is, if I take any of these spin matrices, like sigma x square, let's say, and square it, so multiply it by itself, the answer is I. This identity matrix. That you can check easily. Take any of those matrices, square it. That's easy. And how does this tell you that? Well, you see, if I put A equal to B, then sigma A square, that's the Kronecker delta. So if A is equal to B, that's 1. So you get an I there. And this is this anti-symmetric tensor. I think I once used that before. This is Levi-Civita tensor. As I said, if you don't know what that means, I mean, these days it's very easy. Just type into Google Levi-Civita tensor. You'll find out more than you want to know. Okay. And that tensor, the way it is defined is, it's non-zero only if A, B, and C are three different things. In other words, if it is 1, 1, 2, that's 0. If it's 1, 2, 3, then it's 1. And if it is not in cyclic order, like 1, 3, 2, then it's minus 1. That's basically the definition of that tensor. Okay. Anyway, so in this case, if A is equal to B, it means you're talking of things like 1, 1, whatever. So that's 0. So this then is a special case, just follows from this. This is the general principle. That's a special case of that. See? And yeah, in general, you see, it's nice to have a general thing that you can remember. On the other hand, if you want to understand it, you always have to go back and look at special cases. That's how you get comfortable with the thing. Okay? Okay. Another example is, what's sigma x, sigma y? And this is one property that comes in handy. Can you help me? Let's say I put x, y. So what does the first term give me? 0, because Kronecker delta is 0. Okay. Here, I got x, y, and I have to sum over c, which means the c goes over x, y, and z. So you'd think I'd get three terms, but how many do I get? Just one, because if it's x, it's a repeated index, that tensor is 0. So the only time you get something is when it's z, and so that's equal to I sigma z. Now again, these matrices, of course, you have. I mean, on your page, those are 2x2 matrices. They're right there. And you can multiply it out in a minute and check for yourself. That's indeed true. The thing is, once you know this, it helps you manipulate things because you don't have to keep multiplying matrices all the time. You kind of know these properties. Okay? Okay. Anyway, so let's try to do a simple device then. And the simplest device, as you know, is this one-level device, except that we now have spin involved, so there's these two levels, whose energies, let's say, is a little bit different. So the H, let's say, is equal to, you know, the two levels are a little bit different, so one of them is epsilon plus epsilon prime, and the other is, say, or rather, like epsilon 0 plus a little bit, and epsilon 0 minus a little bit. So two levels, possibly say due to a magnetic field or some other effect, the two spins have a slightly different energy. Now, any idea how I'd write that in terms of polyspin matrices? So rather than write a 2x2 matrix, I'd like to write it in terms of these sigmas and all. How do I write this? Right. So epsilon 0 I. You know, if this was not there, this would have been just an identity matrix times epsilon 0. And then there's the epsilon with a 1 here and a minus 1 here. So like you say, it's epsilon and sigma z. So that's your Hamiltonian. Right? Okay. Now in terms of the contacts, of course, you have got these two contacts. And conceptually, it is useful to separate it out into an upspin contact, which gives you a sigma 1 u, and a downspin contact. I'll call it sigma 1 d, as if you made two separate contacts to the two of them. Conceptually, it's easy. I mean, in practice, it would be hard to make a device that way because those are all mixed up. It got one contact, really, which would have one chemical potential. in the real device. But conceptually, when you are trying to sort out, well, in a device like this, if I inject an upspin electron, what happens? If I'm trying to sort that out, then it's useful to think of it as two separate contacts. You know, put in something from one, see what happens. Okay. And the same here. You could write a sigma 2u and a sigma 2d. Now, question is, how would we write the sigma 1 up, say? So, if, let's say this, you're just making contact to the upspin Z, then the sigma 1 up matrix-wise should look something like this. Right? It's just making contact to the upspin matrix, well, and then multiplied by some constant. And I think we have usually used this minus I alpha over 2, let's say. You know, the sigma must always have a negative imaginary part, right? So that the corresponding gamma is positive. If you remember, gamma is, I think all those equations should be right here. It's I sigma minus sigma dagger. And so if you wrote the corresponding gamma, it would have looked something like this, times alpha. So the alpha then is a measure of how well coupled you are, etc. It would look something like that. Now, how do I write this in terms of polyspin matrices? Can you help me with that? Yeah, it's kind of like a special case of this one with epsilon equals epsilon 0, right? It's kind of, because so that this becomes 0 in a way. It's kind of like that. So as you say, it's like I plus sigma z divided by 2. And one nice thing about doing it this way is, supposing you wanted to make your contact not upspin in the z direction, but upspin in the x direction, let's say. So what we say is, in this device, if I inject a spin along the x direction, what happens to it? Let's say I want to figure out. So then it would be useful to have two separate contacts for up and down along x. Now, question is, if that were the case, so that this up really means up along x, then how would you modify that? You can instinctively see what it should be. It should be I plus sigma x, basically. Okay? So that's the nice thing about using these matrices. You can almost instinctively see what it should be. Of course, what you could do is, you know, say that, well, if I use up and down along x as my basis, this is what it should look like, transform it and all that. But at the end of the day, that's where you'd end up, basically. You see? In fact, let's do that. So we'll use up and down. By up and down, we really mean x, let's say. So what we are really asking for is that this is like plus x. This is like minus x. So in a way, you see, the problem we are trying to do is I have a device where plus z and minus z have two different energies, probably because there's some equivalent of a magnetic field in there in the z direction. And I inject a spin along x. What happens to it? How? What does it do? What current do I get? What spin current do I get? All this kind of stuff. That's what we are trying to do. So that would be a way to do it then would be, you define a sigma, that would be a sigma x in it. H has a sigma z there. Any thoughts on what should be sigma 1 d? Right. Because when I'm trying to write d, it would be sort of like I've got d there, and you'd have a 0 here and a 1 here. And that would be like I minus sigma x. And of course, one easy thing to check always is that since sigma 1 d looks like this and sigma 1 u looks like a 1 there, the sum of the two must be the identity matrix, however you write it. You see? So sigma 1 d would be is enough. And sigma 2u and sigma 2d could be the same thing. I mean, we could, of course, couple them differently, the second contact coupled with some other thing, but we could use the same thing. So let's just use the same. And since there's only one point in the device, I don't have to worry about it. You see, if there were 10 points in the device, then 1 and 2 would be different anyway, because 1 would be coupling to the first point, 2 would be coupling to the last point. But this is a device we are saying, hey, it's just got one point. So it's all the same. Okay. Good. Now, next thing I need to do then is, if I want to use these equations, I'm trying to figure out what is, say, Gn inside the device. That's this electron density. That will give me electron density, spin density, all kinds of stuff. Okay. So first thing I need to do is figure out this Green's function G. So remember, G looks like EI minus H minus sigma 1 minus sigma 2 inverse. You know, all the sigmas. So when I write sigma 1, I really mean sigma 1 U plus sigma 1 D, and sigma 2 is like sigma 2 U plus sigma 2 D, the whole thing. Remember? Because what goes into the Green's function here is all the sigmas, coupling to every contact in there. Everything's in it. So what that would look like then is, I can put in H, it will look like E minus epsilon 0 I minus epsilon sigma Z. Right? So I put in the H. Now, what is sigma 1 and sigma 2? I guess they're equal. So it would be just 2 times any one of them. So can you help me with what sigma 1 u plus sigma 1 d? How much is it? Minus I alpha over 2. Okay? Because if I add these two, the sigma x cancels out, it's just I. So it'll be, I suppose it will be plus I alpha I. So whole thing inverse. Which means, you know, if I were to now write this in the form of a 2x2 matrix, it would look something like this. I do that right? No, plus. So, you know, here I was using the spin matrix notation. Then I'm saying, well, let me just translate it back to a 2x2 so I see cleanly what I'm doing. And now inverting this is very easy because off diagonal elements are 0. So the inverse of this is just 1 divided by this here and 1 divided by that there. That's it. That's easy enough to invert. Yeah. When right? Oh, sorry, sorry. I made, okay, let me. One thing I didn't do is I should, what I was really writing here is sigma 1 up plus sigma 1 down, firstly. Right, okay. And you're saying whether up and down should have two different connection, right? In general, you see, that is how often this magnetic contacts work. But here what I've done is I've kind of idealized it. I said, let's just assume the two contacts are basically equally connected. So I'm not distinguishing this. And then if I want to inject only up spins, what I'll assume is that the Fermi function for this contact is 1. And I'll assume that the Fermi function for this contact is 0, let's say. Now, that's not the way you could do in the real world, though, because in the real world, it's one contact with up and down both in there, and they would usually have the same chemical potential because they would tend to be at equilibrium with each other. So that would be hard to implement. On the other hand, if I'm just trying to figure out that in this device, when I inject an upspin, what happens to it, This is one of the cleanest way of seeing that, right? So that's why I'm doing it this way. Good enough. Okay, so if I invert this, then it will look something like, you know, inverse of this and inverse of this. So it will look like G up, G down, 0, 0, where G up is equal to and G down is the other one. That would be the Green's function. Now, again, if I wanted, I could go back to I's and sigma z's and write it that way. So, any thoughts? What would G look like? Again, you know, it's just like what we had done before, epsilon 0 I plus epsilon sigma z, same kind of idea here. You could write that as G up plus G down over 2 I plus if you like you could break it up that way again. Same thing, isn't it? Because again it's just a diagonal thing, the two are unequal. Two are unequal, so you could, if the two had been exactly equal, it would have been just I. Because the two are unequal, I think you could write it this way. Because remember, the I is 1, 0, 0, 1. Sigma z is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So when I add the two, here I get the sum of these two things, which is g up. And here I get the difference of those two things, which is g down. Right? That's it. Should work. Okay. So, you know, call this, say, G0, and call that, say, GZ. So that way, I don't keep that here. G0 is G up plus G down over 2. GZ is G up minus G down over 2. So now we are ready to find the Gn, the electron density inside the device. How do you do that? If you look at our usual equations, it would be Gn is equal to, if you look at say number 3 for example, and we have got no scattering in there, so that last term is irrelevant, is G gamma 1 G dagger times Fermi function. And so here we got four contacts. In general, you could have four terms. But what we really want to think about is what happens if I only inject electrons from here with an upspin in the plus x direction. So only one of these Fs is 1. Everything else is 0. So what that means is, what I really want is G gamma 1 up G dagger. That's the one I want. I'm only injecting from 1 up. No 1 down, no 2 up or 2 down. Everything else, I'm just injecting up spin x direction, what happens? That's the question we're asking. Okay. Now, what's gamma 1 up? That's like this sigma 1 up, you could, can you help me? So if this is sigma and I'm trying to write gamma, what would we get? Help me. I think it should just be alpha. But I do think it will be the same matrix back again. you know, again, the basic principle, of course, is just that gamma equals sigma minus sigma dagger. So the way I do it is, if I'm trying to find gamma, it's equal to I times sigma is minus I alpha over 2 times I plus sigma x over 2. And then I have to subtract from it the dagger of this, that's the conjugate transpose, and minus I alpha 2, when I take conjugate, it becomes plus I alpha 2, but there's a minus, so I get minus I alpha over 2. And this quantity is all Hermitian, so when I take its dagger, it's really the same thing back again. And so those two things just add up, I times minus I becomes just 1, and so you end up with alpha times I plus sigma x over 2. Okay? That would be the algebra basically. Basic principle is just what I wrote here, gamma equals I sigma minus sigma dagger. Okay, so that's the gamma one. So now the question is, what do I get when I multiply these three matrices out? Noting that the G looks like G0I plus GZ sigma Z. The gamma looks like, what was that? I plus sigma x. And the G dagger, maybe you can help me write. Right? And there's a, I think, the sigma x, and there's the alpha over 2, I'll just put it out here. Can you help me write the G dagger? Yeah, except that this G0 and GZs are complex quantities. So when I take dagger, I should write the conjugates. Okay. So those are the three matrices that I need to multiply out. Now, if I multiply those two things, what will you get? How many terms do you get? Four terms, of course. There's two and two. So what are the four terms? Can you help me? First one is G0 star I. And I'm doing this multiplication. That's this. Then I multiply I with that one. So what do we get? Multiply I with that, what do we get? Just the same thing back. GZ star sigma Z. Next, sigma X times G0 star I, that's also easy. And what's the fourth term? So you get sigma X sigma Z times GZ star. And this is where relations like this come in handy. You see, you got a product of two sigma matrices, two polyspin matrices, but you can replace it with one spin matrix. Okay? So what you could do is, I'll say, okay, sigma x sigma z, that must be like I sigma y, except that it's xz, so it's reverse cyclic, so it'll be minus I sigma y. That's all. So sigma x sigma z just becomes minus I GZ star sigma Y. So that's what you'd get when you multiply out those two matrices. The I matrix, a sigma Z matrix, sigma X, and a sigma Y matrix. And remember, the sigma Y came from multiplying sigma X and sigma Z. Okay, I got three matrices, so I'm just multiplying them in order. Right? So I think I could multiply these two first and then with that, or I could multiply these two first and then with that. I could go either way. A, B, C, you could do A, B and then C, or A, B, C and then A, right? Yes, yes. So sigma x, sigma z is different from sigma z, sigma x. See? That you can check out in a minute, you know, because these are very easy matrices, right? Actually, you know, basically it is this. And you can easily check it out. This and this are not the same. And there's a minus sign between them. This and this. And so this one will be I sigma y. But this one will be minus I sigma y. That's the difference. Yes, please. No, G's are actually just numbers. These are just numbers. Complex numbers, but they're just plain numbers. Right? So the only matrices involved are the I's and sigma z's, sigma x's, etc. That's the only matrices involved. Rest are complex numbers there. So next I want to do the multiplication here, one more multiplication, and let me just write that. So after I have done that, what I will finally get would be something like this. So alpha over 2 in front. Now the first multiplication is easy, it's g0i times this. So it means just everything just gets multiplied by g0 basically. And after all, I times those matrices is the same matrix back again. Nothing much. So, if I wrote out those terms, it would look like g0 square, or I'd write it g0, g0 star, I plus g0, gz star, sigma z, plus g0, g0 star sigma x, and minus I, g0, gz star sigma y. So all I did was took this and multiplied all four of them, and so I got four terms there. Nothing much. The second one is a little trickier because now I am multiplying with sigma z. So first thing I get is gz sigma z times g0 star I. What matrix is that? Well, that's just sigma z. So I can add it here. So this is the sigma z line. So I'll just add it there. So it will be plus gz g0 star sigma z. So, done with the first one. Now, what do I get from the next one? Gz sigma z times gz star sigma z. What is it? See, sigma z squared is I. Remember, that's one of the things I said. This is where the polyspin these identities help. Otherwise, you'd be multiplying 2 by 2 matrices all day. See, this is where it helps. Yeah. Yeah, other than what I had said when I was introducing them, namely that these matrices, because they are these rotation matrices, they have to obey that rule of, you know, Rx, Ry minus Ry, Rx is like Rz, which is the algebra of the rotation group itself. Right? That was the basic idea. And so sigmas also have that basic algebra. But in addition, there are some things that don't quite follow from that, I think. So here, then, this will be gz square I. So I can put that here. So that's the second one. Now the third one is gz, g0 star, and then sigma z, sigma x. What's that? Sigma z, sigma x is I, sigma y. Right? So gz, g0 star, so that's what would go in here. With a sigma y. So that would be the sigma y term. And finally, sigma z sigma y, that's, and then the minus I gz gz star. So sigma z sigma y will give me minus I sigma x, and the minus I and the minus I will give me a minus 1. So I think you will end up with minus gz gz star sigma x. So that's it. When you calculate gn, there will be four terms like this, I, sigma z, sigma x, sigma y. And in general, actually, I mentioned once that if you had any Hermitian matrix, you could always write it as a combination of these four things with real coefficients. Actually, any 2x2 matrix, I think, could be written as a combination of these things. Anyway, so this is how it comes out. Now, as I mentioned before, from gn, if you wanted to know what is the spin density inside your device, how would we do that? Well, that's what I had mentioned here. Right. Take this off. So if I want the, let's say the electron, the spin density in the x direction, then I should multiply with sigma x and take the trace, things like that. Now, what I claim is that if I look at this, one thing I can see right away is that the electron density is that one, the spin density in the z direction is this, spin density in the x direction is this, and the spin density in the y direction is that. Now, let me explain why. The way it would go is something like this. Supposing I want electron density, what would we do? If you wanted electron density, you should just take trace of Gn. Right? That would be the electron density, sum of upspin and downspin. Now, when I take trace of this, what will we get? Well, look at your, look at the spin density, spin matrices. Trace of sigma z is 0, trace of sigma x is 0, trace of sigma y is 0. The only thing that doesn't have a 0 trace is that guy. You see? So, if I take trace of Gn, it will just be alpha times g0, g0 star plus gc, gz star. So, that's the electron density inside the device. Right? And g0 and gz, of course, we had are in terms of these things that we had done before. Now, let's say I want the spin density in the z direction. So then I'm supposed to multiply it with sigma z and take the trace. Now, question is, what do we get then? You see, when I multiply with sigma z, what will happen is I times sigma z, that's what will become a sigma z there. Then sigma z times sigma z squared, that's what will become I. Sigma z times sigma x is what will become like sigma y. And sigma z times sigma y is what will become like sigma x. And when I trace it, none of these will give me anything. The only one that will give me anything is that guy, of course. So what that means is, I could have in the first place just looked at that and said, okay, yeah, that's the z spin. You see? But this is how you'd get it. So the finally the answer is alpha times none. And you can prove the next one. Like if you want x spin, it's trace of gn sigma x. And again, same story, what will contribute is only this one, because when I multiply by sigma x, this is the one that will become I, sigma x square being I. And that's the one that will contribute to my trace. So this is the electron density. That's the spin density in the z direction, that's the spin density in the x direction, that's the spin density in the y direction. So physically you might say, well, what happened here? Here was a device that had a magnetic field in the z direction, because of which, of course, there was this little splitting between the two levels, and I injected a spin in the x direction. And what I find inside my device is spins in all three directions, x, y, and z, to some extent, right? And I guess part of it is because when you're injecting in the x direction and you have something in the z direction, it rotates around the z direction. It's supposed to precess. And so x tends to go a little bit into y, etc. And all that is just reflected in this calculation. It's in there, right? So let me stop here today and we'll continue with this.